This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Women have been trying to climb the corporate ladder for years. Sometimes that involves filing class action suits to fight against the cultural norms that keep women out of those top jobs. The trouble is there are rules for filing those class action suits, and they're written mostly by men, which is what Seattle University law professor Brooke Coleman writes about in Slate magazine. Brooke, what recent cases are you talking about here?
Well, the one that comes to mind immediately is Walmart, which was a very high-profile national case where the Supreme Court put a pretty heavy limitation on the way that classes can be certified. Since then, courts have followed suit. And so most recently, we've seen, even in the Western District of Washington, our own Judge Robart refusing to certify a class action of Microsoft software engineers, a group of women who felt like the way the Microsoft promotion and pay system was set up. And what he says is that there's not enough of what he calls commonality between their experiences to be able to allow those women to come together in a suit against Microsoft, meaning that they'd have to file their cases individually, which, as you can imagine, is harder because there's definitely more power when a number of women can band together to bring their claims than when they have to do it one-on-one.
And so as a result, these cases go nowhere. But why would these rules be different depending on whether you're a man or a woman? Because there are sometimes groups of men that want to form a class action lawsuit. Wouldn't this just be just as hard on them?
Every kind of case in a court has the same kind of federal rules that apply to it. So if there were some kind of discretionary, kind of unwritten discrimination against men, they would be subject to the same sets of rules. And that's definitely not something that I would have a problem with. What I have a problem with is that we know both statistically and through studies that it's women and women of all colors, and of course, men of color, who experience these kinds of discriminations on a larger basis. And if the rules are not structured so that they can find a way to be able to bring their case into court to get some kind of remedy, then I think we have a problem.
So in the Microsoft case, for these women, and there's about 8,000 of them, I believe, to be certified as a class for purposes of a lawsuit, they would have to find some memo spelling out, you shall discriminate against all of these women, and then they could sue as a group?
That's what's so problematic about this. I mean, I think that's right. It feels as if you must have some kind of smoking gun. And we know that's just not the way that discrimination works. I wrote an article a couple of years ago that looked at this. And when the class action rule was originally adopted in 1966, women were able to bring their class actions pretty easily because you had those kinds of policies. They were written. You can't work here anymore when you're 7 months pregnant. Well, that's pretty clearly discriminatory against women on the basis of their gender, since we're the ones who can get pregnant. But then once that kind of discrimination gets more structural and gets more institutionalized, you don't have those kinds of documents floating around. And we know that discrimination works in a very kind of inchoate, less clear way. It's not always written down. It's not as if somebody always says exactly what they're thinking. And remember here, when we're talking about certifying a class, we're not talking about winning the case. We're talking about whether or not that class gets to go forward and do some discovery, get information from a company like Microsoft and dig deeper into its promotion and pay policies. And then we have to see whether or not these women can prove their case in a court of law. So this is way, way, way ahead of trial. This is just one of the first steps. But if at the very beginning these women are not allowed to certify their class, it takes away a lot of the power that they have as a group because now they have to act individually, which you can imagine is harder for an attorney to want to take on. Financially, it's harder for them to do so.
But if the corporations are so insidious about this that they have stopped writing things down or doing this with a wink and a nod, what's there to discover?
Well, this is the thing that I think is really interesting about discrimination is that it's almost as if we've gotten to the point where if someone says something that is inappropriate, everyone gets defensive and they feel labeled as a racist. And I think we've got to completely change that narrative. I don't think these companies are necessarily acting in a way that is, as you said, insidious. I think maybe some are, but I'm not sure that Microsoft is. I think we don't understand the way groups work, and groups tend to mentor and network and kind of promote their own. And if you have a group of software engineers, for example, that are predominantly white and male, one can imagine that there are some subtle kind of implicit biases that occur that keep women from succeeding. And I think all women are asking for here is, hey, let's crack this open and let's look at this and let's create some structures that will allow for women to succeed as well. Well, we can't do that until we either have these companies look more deeply into this, or for lack of a better word, we just have to sue them to get them to take notice of what they need to do to make this better. I think a lot of these women would feel great if Microsoft would sit down and say, okay, structurally, we need to look at this and come up with ways. We know that, for example, if you take a woman's name and put it on the same resume and put a man's name on the same resume, a lot of times the man will get hired by both men and women. I mean, these are the kinds of implicit biases that we all have.
Seattle University Law Professor Brooke Coleman, her latest article is at slate.com. Brooke, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Autoimmune diseases like arthritis can be very painful, but there's new research indicating that one of the causes may be bacteria lurking in your digestive system. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Autoimmune diseases, this is when your body's immune system turns on itself, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Dave. Good morning. An autoimmune disease is a condition where your immune system, your body's own immune system, mistakenly attacks your body itself. The body's natural defense system can't tell the difference between your own cells and foreign cells. And so it causes the body to mistakenly attack the normal cells. The immune system mistakes part of your own body, for example, like your joints or your skin, as being foreign, and then it releases proteins called autoantibodies that then attack these healthy cells.
Okay, and this latest research indicates that it's gut bacteria, bacteria in your digestive system, which can trigger these symptoms. Now, what strikes me as important about that is that bacteria is very often controlled by your diet. This would imply that perhaps by some changes in diet, you could treat some of these symptoms or prevent them entirely?
We don't actually know what causes the immune system to essentially misfire. We do know, however, that there are some people that are more likely to get an autoimmune disease than others. So, for example, women get autoimmune diseases about twice as often as men. And oftentimes, for whatever reason, the disease will start during a woman's childbearing years. This most recent study that came out of Queen's University in Belfast in the UK, the researchers there noticed for the first time that one of the specific bacteria that live in our guts called Bacteroides fragilis, and it's a bacterium that normally lives in our human gut, so it's in everybody. Mm-hmm. But they found that it produces a specific protein that mimics a human protein that causes the defense system in our body to turn on its own cells by mistake. So this protein is called ubiquitin, and it's found in almost all cellular tissues in humans and other animals, actually.
It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere.
And what these scientists found is that this very common gut bacteria called Bacteroides fragilis actually produces a protein that very much looks like ubiquitin. And this protein may be part of what's causing the immune system to get confused and attack itself. And so the question is there's something that's different. Is it the population of Bacteroides fragilis? Is it the amount of protein that it's producing? Mm-hmm. Is it something that in your diet that's affecting? I mean, we're really not quite sure. This is really just the first step in understanding it. But autoimmune diseases are common. It's an extensive list of diseases. So, you know, the most common types, for example, are rheumatoid arthritis, which is really a chronic inflammatory disorder that affects the joints, including those in the hands and feet. Lupus, which a lot of people have heard of, and it's an inflammatory disease that's caused when the immune system basically attacks itself and the whole body. Celiac disease, which is kind of popular these days because it's an immune reaction to eating gluten, which is a protein found in wheat, barley, and rye. So you hear about a lot of people having gluten sensitivity. Multiple sclerosis, like you mentioned, which is a disease in which the immune system attacks the protective covering of the nerves. Actually, type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. And this is a chronic condition in which the pancreas produces little or no insulin, and it's an autoimmune disease.
But you seem to be telling me that while this is a breakthrough study, it doesn't really help you decide whether it's the food you're eating that has triggered your autoimmune disease.
it's really too early. All we know at this point is that this bacteria produces this important regulatory protein found in eukaryotic cells, which is what human cells are. And so there is very likely a link between the activity of this specific bacteria in our gut and the development of an autoimmune disease. And so it would be amazing if we could actually discover exactly that link, because research like this could really have far-reaching effects for other diseases and not just autoimmune diseases.
I know that a lot of people swear by some sort of nutrition therapy for diseases like this. So what's your stand in general when somebody says, look, the problem with your rheumatoid arthritis, your lupus, it's your diet. Let's change what you eat, and maybe that'll work. I mean, where do you stand on stuff like that?
You know, really the basis of all disease is inflammation. So anything we can do to reduce inflammation in our body is helpful. So there are a lot of anti-inflammatory diets. There's a lot of anti-inflammatory foods. Although there are some diseases that can be cured, for example, with appropriate diet and exercise and lifestyle modification, you can cure type 2 diabetes. But for the most part, diseases aren't going to be cured with diet and exercise alone, but you can actually reduce the symptomatology. So I think diet plays a super important role, but I think that in some of these more severe conditions, diet alone isn't going to be what fixes it.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. Cairo Radio and Snohomish County have teamed up to help raise the $6 million needed to build a memorial park at the site of the Oso landslide, where 43 people died. And today, Hannah Scott brings us a story of the local fire chief who became the face of the slide during those first days. Hannah?
Travis Hotz is now Snohomish County's fire chief for District 22 in Getchell. On the day of the slide, he was the Arlington Heights fire chief, a job he'd held only 3 months at the time. And despite his years of experience and extensive training, a job that was about to test him in ways he'd never imagined. The morning of the slide, he got a page about a swift water rescue. Those calls are risky, so he decided to head out with his crew from Arlington towards Darrington along State Route 530.
As I was traveling up 530, I started to hear the radio traffic that was taking place of the units that had arrived on the scene first and were there working. And I could tell that there was, you know, rescues that were in progress. People were hearing people screaming and yelling for help, that type of thing. So I thought, oh, there must be something fairly significant up this way. But nothing could have prepared my imagination for what I was about to encounter when I got there.
As he drove down 530, Chief Hotz realized there was a slide of some sort ahead, and he imagined it was in a large area where there had been some slides in the past.
As I arrived down on the actual slide, it was substantially larger than I had imagined. In fact, it was so large that I actually wasn't even sure that some of the big piles of sand that were 70, 80 feet high were part of it. I thought that was a separate, like, construction project maybe that was taking place up there. So the whole thing was really hard to get your head around and comprehend.
From that vantage point, he couldn't actually tell where the slide had come from and where all the mud and debris crews were searching for was from. He didn't get a good idea until he got back to the command post in Arlington and watched the images taken by the sheriff's helicopter.
There's all these addresses with the road, but the actual view of what they were seeing in the video, or what we were seeing in the video, just showed this huge pile of mud. It realized the severity and complexity of this whole incident was substantially larger than I had first thought it was.
Chief Hotz knew he and the local teams could not manage it on their own, so they called for an incident management team. As Arlington's chief, Hotz had worked closely with the fire chiefs of Darrington and Oso over the years, and as well as their crews, and on that first day soon learned that a firefighter he knew out of Oso had lost his home and family in the slide.
It chokes you up, but you fully realize that you have a job to do and you need to put your emotions aside, and that's difficult to do. And you just got to buckle down and get it done.
As the incident management team arrived the second day, so did the media. It was decided that Chief Hotz, who had no background in public speaking or spokesperson work, would be the one to talk to the press. For the first week, Chief Hotz was the face of the slide, holding multiple press conferences a day as local, national, and international media converged on Oso.
It was a very difficult situation because you knew emotions were running very, very strong and hard with people that were literally sitting on the edge of their seat waiting for answers. You know, it's their friends, it's their relatives, their loved ones that we're out there trying to find.
In the initial days, the number of missing was put in the hundreds because of reports from people who couldn't get a hold of their loved ones, who may or may not have been in the area of the slide. It ended up being a smaller number, but it took days of investigation to figure that all out, and media got impatient with the lack of information. Hotz was visibly emotional at a press conference when he was being pressured on the numbers, one of his last. But he says that was not the hardest part of this duty.
One of the hardest things that I have found in this business is when we're dealing with disaster is dealing with the people that are still alive, the family members and the friends, and having to look people in the eye and tell them, you know, this is a dire, grave situation. We're doing the very best we can, but the outcome is likely not going to be very good. That's tough because you could see the hope in every one of these people's eyes. They are just sitting on the edge of their seat, just waiting for you to tell them something that's going to change what's going to take place for them.
And it's something that stuck with Hotz, especially in the initial first months after the slide.
I'll be honest with you. I have never experienced post-traumatic stress syndrome in my entire career, 25 years doing this, until this particular incident happened. And I would not be able to fall asleep at night. And I'd just lay there and I'd look at the ceiling fan in the dark. And I would wonder, I would worry, is this a new normal for me? When the last person was found, It was like the flick of a light switch.
And Chief Hotz knows there are others who responded to the Oso slide who still struggle all the years after it. That's one of the reasons he says it's vital the money get raised to build this memorial park at the slide site to replace the temporary memorial of 43 trees that were planted at the site for each of the victims.
You know, I stop at the current memorial that they have there. I wouldn't say every time I go up there, but I'd say a super majority of the time I do stop and I get out. And I reflect a little bit about, you know, what took place there. And I think it's healing. And I think a proper memorial there is something that's needed.
Boy, he's still affected by it, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I was at the press conference the day that he got very emotional. There were no new numbers. There was a lot of pressure coming from the media. And he didn't have any information. You told me he learned from this experience that when you don't have any more information, just to cancel the press conference, it wrecked him. And it stuck with him. But like he said, when they found the last person who was missing in the slide, he got some peace. He goes to the current memorial to get peace. A lot of the other firefighters we've talked to during the series also say they heal if they go to the memorial, and they're hoping this gets built. I want to point out, you guys have helped, our listeners have helped raise more than $60,000 towards this already through this series. We're just going to be doing a few more stories on this. So you can help out by going, texting the word OSO to 98973. You can also get a look at the memorial and other stories that we've run about this at mynorthwest.com/helpOSO.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, Danny O'Neill. Certainly points for effort. But, yeah, it was a heartbreaker, which you called. I mean, you know what was going to happen.
It was an unlikely to win game, right?
Right.
You said it would be close, though. You said it'd be close, but they would lose. And look at you. You did.
Well, let's not get carried away. But the Rams, and this is the concerning part for the Seahawks, they showed that they can run the ball against the Rams' defense. And they kept pace, and they've stayed in it, but they haven't been able to get over the hump this season. They've not been able to get over... And they've been in games. They're 1-5 in games that are single possession games. They've won 3 games by fairly lopsided margins. They don't get blown out, but they're 1-5 in games that where they could have won. And that's probably going to end up biting them in the butt when it comes to the playoffs. That they're not able to get over the hump at the end of those games.
There's a momentum issue somewhere, I think. I mean, you can tell, you know, they have that. Classic fourth quarter comeback attempt, but also in other portions of the game, they get into a rhythm and suddenly, you know, they can do no wrong. And then something happens. There's that unsportsmanlike conduct penalty. And it, for some reason, the energy then just drains out of the team.
They're not a consistent offense. And when they're put in a position where they need to throw for chunks of yardage, they have a really tough time. And that's a difficult recipe in today's NFL. And their defense, when their defense is not good enough to stay ahead in those low scoring nip and tuck games, it's not unusual for them to be behind or even trailing on the road going into the fourth quarter, but it's not usually in the 20s and 30s. And that's a reflection of a defense that's not as good as it once was.
Explain the onside kick. And, I mean, I thought that you'd never let the ball get airborne because of what actually happened, where the guy just caught it.
It's actually better. It's usually better to pop it up in the air and have it coming down. The ball has to travel 10 yards before your team can touch it if you're going to recover it. Like, that's the rule of the onside kick. The ball must go. You're kicking off from the 30. It has to get to the 40 before any player from the kicking team can touch it without it being a penalty. And as it's coming down, you want it at that 10-yard mark to that be the first point that they can touch it.
Unless you kick it on a diagonal.
Yes, you want it on an angle. You want it toward the sideline.
Yeah.
Because that will give your team the maximum run-up time. If you kick it on the ground, the problem is the other team can run in front of it. They can run and recover it after it's gone 5 yards. And your team at that point, if he fields it cleanly, doesn't even have a shot. So it's better to kick up in the air, and then as it's coming down, your team's got a shot to do it. Janikowski mishit the kick. I wasn't against that call. And I know a lot of people look at the Seahawks weren't stopping him. Like, they'd forced one punt at that point. And so you give him a shorter field to work with, but it's not like you'd been forcing punts anyway. So I didn't have that much of a problem with that one.
Can we talk a little bit about what happens if the Seahawks get sold? There was a write-up in the Seattle Times about Paul Allen's estate, and that it is going to get sold. Do we know who the potential buyers are?
No, and it hasn't been put up for sale yet. So we don't. The expectation most people have around the NFL is that it will eventually be sold. Every NFL owner is required to have a succession plan, to state and file with the league what their plan is if something happens to them. And that's largely to provide some clarity if there is a tragic or surprising or unexpected death, that you don't have the heirs fighting over the team. It still happens. Teams still do have the Broncos have one right now where family members are fighting over it.
Oh, really?
But you have so. The expectation is they are going to be sold, and I think that dates back and comes back. Other owners have seen what his succession plan was, that ultimately the team will be sold. The report this weekend was that any benefits from that, the sale price, because it's probably, if the Seahawks are going to be sold, it's probably going to set a record for a sale price of a North American sports franchise.
And why is that?
Because of the value of NFL franchises. Oh. And,
so it's not the Seahawks necessarily, just an NFL franchise.
It's also a really good market.
Yeah, it's a good market, okay. Like incredibly affluent. Like other NFL teams have sold recently because of the value that it has. And that those proceeds would go to the Paul G. Allen Foundation, which is kind of the nexus for all his endeavors.
Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Danny, thank you.
You bet.
Veterans Day is also a good time to stop and think about the more than 18 million people we live and work with who fought for our country. CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland joins us live now. First, can we give us an update, would you, on reforms at the VA? It's dropped out of the news, and I assume that's good because it means things are working and there are no longer waiting lines?
Well, there are no longer waiting lines in terms of the, or if there's been an improvement. I should say there's still waiting lines. There's still there's an improvement in terms of the waiting for care at VA facilities. There's no doubt about that. But over the weekend, we saw a new problem with the VA as Congress has voted new benefits for military members to go back to college, get training if they leave the military service. We're finding out an enormous backlog in those veterans being provided those benefits. And in some cases, it's going on for months and months. So we have veterans who are now losing their apartments, are not able to pay their college tuition because they're not getting the tuition benefits that they were promised by the VA due to now a computer backlog due to this new benefits package that has been put in place by Congress because of antiquated software and hardware at the VA.
I hadn't heard a thing about that. So there's no hope of fixing that quickly? They have to undergo a whole reboot?
Apparently, I mean, there's going to be a congressional hearing for the Congressional Committee on Veteran Affairs on Wednesday morning. I've forgotten the congressman's name from the great state of Tennessee, but he has called this a train wreck of mammoth proportions because literally they have thousands and thousands of veterans who are in college right now or getting training or not getting paid their college tuition benefits or their housing allowances. And obviously that's only going to get worse because when's the big influx of requirements to pay benefits? At the onset of semesters. Well, last time I checked, January follows December, and you're going to have an increased backlog because more veterans who are rolling into classes beginning with the January semester.
That's crazy. That sounds like something the president should be tweeting about. Is he? I assume this has been brought to his attention?
I don't know. I would hope it's been brought to the president's attention, but it does seem clear that the Congress is aware of this. NBC actually put out, dare I say it, a long article about this. But certainly, you know, as we're celebrating Veterans Day and people go around, you know, congratulating and thanking people for their service, you know, why don't we get together and contact our congressman and say, hey, why don't you take care of those veterans? We're only asking that they get the benefits they were promised when they had served their country honorably.
Exactly. Yikes, it was not one thing as another. On the subject of what to say to a veteran, this was, did you see the Saturday Night Live incident involving Pete Davidson, Jeff?
I did, and I thought it was extraordinary.
Yeah.
Just extraordinary.
This is Lieutenant Commander Dan Crenshaw on Saturday Night Live.
Tell a veteran, never forget. When you say never forget to a veteran, you are implying that, as an American, you are in it with them. Not separated by some imaginary barrier between civilians and veterans, but connected together as grateful fellow Americans who will never forget the sacrifices made by veterans past and present, and never forget those we lost on 9/11.
Crenshaw wears a patch over his eye, and I guess he was running as a Republican in a race, and Davidson made fun of him the previous week, saying something about pirates and porn stars or something. Anyway, apparently didn't even look into the reason he had the patch on his eye. And, of course, it turned out it was a battle injury. So they appeared together. And I guess the extraordinary thing, at least talking to people around here, was that they ended up shaking hands. This is one of those things that could easily turn into a flame war, right? But they decided to take control of it and ended as friends, which I thought set a pretty good example.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. I mean, Crenshaw went so far as to make some fun of the Saturday Night Live comedian, which made it kind of funny. But at the end of the day, shook hands, apology accepted as the Saturday Night Live people apologized publicly to Crenshaw. And they made that point, though certainly coming out of a very contentious election. We're divided by our political views. There's no doubt about it. But we're united as Americans. And I still believe firmly that there is far more that holds us together than divides us. And we saw that during the election, when thousands of people turned out, they're all standing in line. I didn't see any fistfights between Democrats and Republicans. Maybe I missed all that. But it looked like people were conducting themselves pretty well and doing what citizens should do.
Amen. Colonel Jeff McCausland, Jeff, thank you very much.
Always a great pleasure, you guys. Happy Veterans Day to all those veterans out there.
Amen to that, too. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. As you know, there is no cure for Alzheimer's, but there are a lot of new programs out there to make it a little better, and one of them is called Music Mends Minds. Mends Minds. And the International Rotary is doing this program, and I attended one of the sessions on Mercer Island. Amy Huggins is with Rotary, and the idea, we had a group of us, most of them were a little bit older than I was, but what we did was we sang songs that everybody remembered with the words on. So it's basically, you know, karaoke sing-along, and people seem to love it. But this is more than just recreation, according to you, right?
Absolutely.
So tell me what's the science behind this.
There's very good science, Dave, about the effect of music on the brain, because music affects what's called neuroplasticity, which essentially is the ability of the brain to change, repair, reorganize itself. And because music lights up more areas of the brain than even reading or doing math problems or sports, mm-hmm. because of the emotional content, the melody, the rhythm, the connection from where you were memory-wise when you first learned this song, it all just generates the ability of the brain to reconnect with all those triggers, if you will, like an executive function.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what's the goal of this? I mean, it's any senior center could get people together and sing along. But you are trying a more directed program, it looks like.
Exactly. We have learned that the importance of bringing people out of isolation when they have Alzheimer's, dementia, Parkinson's, or stroke, or PTSD symptoms is that they tend to withdraw from society because of a little bit of shame and not understanding exactly what's going on in conversations with other people. So bringing them together to sing and or play instruments together is a way to provide meaning in their life again and reconnect them into community.
What improvements do you see in the patients that you serve with this program over the course of time?
We see specifically that people who participate in this program over time, whether they are playing instruments or singing along and playing hand instruments, Colleen, is that they tend, like in Parkinson's patients, for example, to get off some medications and find the ability to walk even better.
Wow.
Just by singing?
Yeah. That's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this important to you to get the word out, Amy?
Because both my father died of Alzheimer's after 10 years of suffering from it, and so did my husband.
Mm. What did you experience during that time? And what did you do after? Did you develop this program?
I didn't develop the program. It's actually a nonprofit in Los Angeles that was founded in 2014 by Carol Rosenstein, whose husband, Erwin, had Parkinson's. He was a retired attorney, but she noticed when he sat down at the piano and played as an amateur piano player that something shifted.
Uh-huh.
She saw a difference in her husband. So she went to UCLA and said, "What's going on?" And they did the fMRI scans and PET scans to try to find out, as they watched Erwin play piano, what was happening in his different brain regions, and found out this amazing ability of music to light up all those areas of the brain that I mentioned. So she went to the Alzheimer's support group and Parkinson's support groups in Los Angeles and found other people who had amateur backgrounds in playing music and singing and formed a band called the Fifth Dementia.
Wait a second. The Fifth Dementia?
Wow. That's cute. I think you're going to find in speaking here today that many people are going to be grappling for information on how they can bring a loved one to one of these events. You don't need to be a member of Rotary to attend one of these.
No, you don't.
That's great. How many locally? Because you went to the one on Mercer Island, right, Dave, but there are others locally?
Yes, there's currently a group in Olympia, in Puyallup, on Mercer Island, and in West Seattle, and Vashon Island.
Yeah, and you also don't have to have Alzheimer's to attend one of them.
No.
Because as far as I know, I don't have it yet. And I had a good time singing along. And it was really fun watching people, obviously, as they sang, thinking of what they were doing when they had first learned that song.
That's absolutely true, Dave. You know, people go, "Oh, I learned that at camp," or "I learned that from my grandmother," or it's like the memory kicks in. The music brings that back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Amy, it sounds like a great program. And so where can people easily find out more information about you and your...
I would recommend going to the nonprofit's website to begin with. Mm-hmm. Music Mends, that's M-E-N-D-S, Minds, M-I-N-D-S, .org. And on that website, we have very good information about the research behind it, as well as all the media outreach that the nonprofit is doing to try to spread the word about the effectiveness of this program.
Very good. Music Mends Minds. Amy Huggins, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.